Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. Federal workers may miss yet another paycheck this week as part of the government remains shut down. The president made an offer to Democrats over the weekend. Democrats rejected it. Also in the news, Democratic Senator Kamala Harris announced her bid to become president. For the latest, here's NPR's congressional correspondent Scott Detrow. Hi, Scott.
Hey there.
So Donald Trump offered temporary protected status to DACA recipients, the children of undocumented immigrants, in exchange for border wall funding. Democratic leaders have called for renewal of DACA since the president ended it years ago, but they rejected this offer. Why?
Two reasons. First of all, Democrats are not backing down from their stance all along that they don't want to negotiate until the federal government is reopened. The second reason is that President Trump is offering a 3-year extension. Democrats want a permanent fix for people in DACA. And Democrats are making the argument that President Trump is the one who ended the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. So they don't exactly see it as a magnanimous offer if President Trump is offering to extend the things that he's the one who ended in the first place.
So bring into the picture Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who says that he'll bring the matter to a vote this week, with Democrats saying that they are opposed. What is the sense in his bringing this to the floor?
I think it's interesting that Mitch McConnell is getting engaged in this process again. He's a major figure in Washington, but he's basically been on the sidelines by his choosing the entire shutdown. If by bringing this to a vote on the Senate, McConnell could, hypothetically, of course, create circumstances for at least a serious negotiation to begin between Democrats and Republicans about what they would want to see in some sort of deal.
So presumably all parties are feeling more pressure now. But I wonder specifically where they're feeling it from, because we're more than a month into the shutdown. What are the most troubling problems from a political perspective? Where are the sharpest ends coming from? Would it be air traffic control, TSA, national parks, or someplace else?
That's certainly the ones you mentioned are the ones that are certainly in the public's mind the most. You know, there's this interesting split here where Democrats are regularly talking about the 800,000 federal employees who have now gone a month without pay, the millions of contractors in the same position. But President Trump, by and large, continues to not show much public empathy for these people. Over the weekend, when he gave this speech laying out these terms for a deal, he didn't mention federal employees at once. You have seen the public polling that President Trump is taking more of a share of the blame than Democrats. That leaves Democrats pretty comfortable, but you have a lot of Democrats representing states like Virginia, Maryland, and other states with a ton of federal employees who want to see this end, who are really uncomfortable with so many constituents going without pay.
So is there any kind of light at the end of the tunnel right now?
I think at the moment, no. You have seen President Trump make an initial offer to Democrats. You have seen Democrats show an interest in raising the amount of money they would spend on border security, if not a wall. These are first steps, but I think there's a long way to go before any sort of serious deal breaks out. The State of the Union may not happen because House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said it doesn't make sense to do this with the costs and the security risks, given so many federal employees charged with security are not getting paid.
Scott, I want to ask you about the latest Democrat to throw her hat into the presidential ring. Here's the first ad that we heard from Kamala Harris.
The future of our country depends on you and millions of others lifting our voices to fight for our American values. That's why I'm running for president of the United States.
Scott, remind us who the other presidential candidates, or at least right now, wannabes are.
Yeah, Kamala Harris is the third sitting senator to get into the race officially, say she's going to run. An incredibly diverse field is shaping up, and I think you have to put Kamala Harris at the top of the list or among the top candidates right now. Even though she's only been in the Senate for 2 years, she's really made a name for herself with Democratic voters nationwide, and the fact that she comes from such a big state, California, and the fact that she's a black woman in a party that is increasingly mindful of how important black women are to their base, I think gives her a big advantage, even though she's going to have to work over the next year to really build her national name ID.
The other women being Elizabeth Warren, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Tulsi Gabbard, and one man. I have a question about that. Is it, at this point, do polls say that women, as they have in the past, when they're running, run at an automatic deficit because of their gender?
You know, I'm not sure, and I think that's something that as the field strengthens and widens and as voters have an actual sense of who these candidates are, as opposed to just have I heard this name before, we'll watch for. On the other hand, you saw a record number of women being elected to the House of Representatives and other positions last year. And on top of that, you saw over and over again when a woman was in the primary ballot in the Democratic Party, she tended to do pretty well and win a lot of these races. So I think at least among Democratic primary voters, there's a real enthusiasm to break those historical trends.
Scott Detrow, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, social media exploded over the weekend after that video showing a group of male Catholic high school students wearing Make America Great Again hats in front of the Lincoln Memorial, yelling taunts at Native Americans. Things like build the wall. One young man stands staring at Elder Nathan Phillips of the Omaha Tribe of Nebraska, who was drumming, and we learn had walked over to the young men to try to calm down two groups. Other videos soon emerged and showed that earlier both the students who'd been participating in the Pro-Life March for Life and the Native Americans from the Indigenous Peoples March were being harassed by a third group calling themselves Black Hebrew Israelites. Now, people in that movement believe that Black Americans are the descendants of ancient Israelites. But there are extremist wings described as black supremacist and anti-Semitic. We have to bleep what seemed like those black Israelites in the mall hurling slurs at the young Catholic men about whites being crackers.
You got all these dirty behind you with a red Make America Great hat again on.
So there was a lot going on. Vincent Schilling is associate editor at Indian Country Today. Vincent, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So first of all, tell us about the Black Israelites. As we said, there is a movement across the country of black people, African Americans, who think they are descendants of the original Israelites. But there's also, the Southern Poverty Law Center tells us that there's a black supremacist wing of this movement.
Right. You know, and I did a lot of research over the weekend, and a lot of people actually tweeted to me. And as we saw in some of the video, some of their, you know, whatever they believe specifically came out in a lot of volatility. And, you know, I think some folks could ascertain that they have extreme views, and you know, it was not pleasant to watch. It was pretty harmful language, I felt.
They were taunting the young men, as we heard in our introduction, but here they are taunting the Native Americans.
Before you started worshiping totem poles, you was worshiping the true living God.
That's right.
And this is the reason why this land was taken away from you.
And they go on to call the Native Americans idol worshippers. So this was fomenting before a young man from the Catholic school came and had the standoff with Nathan Phillips, the Omaha elder who we see drumming and singing. Right. He has said that he didn't really understand what he was wading into.
Right, right. And I actually talked to him. He said, well, you know, he looked at the situation and then he realized once he was into it, he's like, okay, now I kind of was almost even outside of myself going, what have I gotten myself into?
Right.
And, you know, I thought about it, and this is a very cultural thing. If I was having an argument with someone and I was getting volatile, and then a Native elder came and started playing the drum, my Native culture, and I'm not speaking for all Natives, I'm speaking for myself, I would freeze in my tracks and be like, well, okay, this is a song and this is an honoring moment. I've got to stop what I'm doing. And I believe that's what he was, and I'm going to talk to him further, but that was an attempt to stop all of the situation. And then it just kind of continued to spiral out of control. And as many of us have seen the video, it got to epic proportions.
Well, because there had already been a lot of testosterone spewed in this, in the interaction between the young black men and the young white men in the MAGA hats. I mean, you might say, well, these young men were being provoked by another group of young men. But you can't overlook the things that they were saying to the Native Americans, these, again, the young men in the MAGA hats. Things like, build the wall, build the wall. I mean, what's the reaction of an Indigenous person to that?
Well, see, the thing is and even Nathan Phillips said it, there were, you know, this is the land that we've lived on for countless, countless generations. And to say build a wall, you know, when we were, as Native people, expected to embrace everyone who came in and, you know, to hear people say build a wall to a person whose generations and generations have lived here in this land. And now to say build a wall, it's like, what are you trying to keep out? It has nothing to do with me.
Then you had so much else piled on here. You have the mother of one of the young boys from the Catholic school with the MAGA hats, outraged that the boys were being vilified, pointing to the young black men, blaming them for provoking the situation, but calling them black Muslims.
Yes, she did. It was so incendiary that four black Muslims was trending on Twitter for a while. You know, it goes to show that a lot of times people will speak their minds a lot of times without doing some research or without finding out what is behind everything. And people took to Twitter immediately to say, look, we're going to correct you. You cannot say this and that, and you're not speaking correctly about your statements. And It was just an absolute weekend of chaos. You know, on a side note, I had 1 hour sleep in about 3 days because I wanted to make sure and cover as much of it as I could. And it just continued to unfold all weekend long.
Quite a moment. Vincent Schilling, associate editor at Indian Country Today. Vincent, thank you.
Hey, thanks for the time.
So this is Wild Geese. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine.
But mostly, poet Mary Oliver told us of her amazement, her wonder, her work, which, as she wrote, was standing still and learning to be astonished. She asked us, tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? And she gave us an answer. Instructions for living a life, she wrote. Pay attention. Be astonished. Tell about it. Mary Oliver died Friday at 83. Her work will live on. We know she believed we all will, just as a beloved buried dog will sprout a rose bush next spring. All weekend, she's been trending on social media. Wonder what she would have thought of that. She won a Pulitzer in 1984, later a National Book Award, was beloved. But did she get the critical recognition she should have? Ruth Franklin's piece in The New Yorker in 2017 was titled What Mary Oliver's Critics Don't Understand. Ruth, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Before we get to that, and this, by the way, will come as a shock to people for whom she was life-saving. I mean, that's how you begin your article, a fictional character saying, Mary Oliver saved my life.
That's right. And, you know, if you just Google that phrase, you'll see it everywhere on social media, on people's personal blogs, on people's prayer blogs. Believe it, there is such a thing. Mm. She was just adored by people who felt that she had the right words for them at the most difficult moments of their lives.
Yeah. This is a character, Paul Chowder, in a novel from Nicholson Baker, in which, you know, the character is trying to find something to save his life. He goes through different poets and he comes upon Mary Oliver. And he says of her poems, you write, they're very simple. Each has something. Immediately, I felt more sure of what I was doing.
I suspect that Nicholson Baker was kind of making a little joke at it in the novel because this character is an academic poetry critic. And that's just the sort of person who was least likely, unfortunately, to appreciate Mary Oliver during her lifetime.
Well, we'll talk a bit about that, but first a thumbnail of that lifetime. She wandered the woods mostly on Cape Cod with Walt Whitman in her backpack, her notebook and pen, observing the world, turning it into her beautiful poetry. Outside rather than in, because as she told Krista Tippett of On Being in her incredible interview, and we'll link you to it at hereandnow.org, I don't care for the enclosure of buildings, and that has been traced back to the fear of her father, memories of abuse at his hands, a neglectful mother, a house that she hated and had to get out of. And so where do we see that in her poetry? What is, for the uninitiated, what is she doing?
There's a sense in her poetry of somebody who is very independent, very individual, in the tradition of the American poets she loved, like Whitman, striking out on her own to begin a totally new life. She left home at a very young age and kind of bounced around, I think, a bit from place to place before settling in Provincetown on Cape Cod and conducting the life that she did the way she writes about it in her poems, encountering the natural world, walking on the beach, fishing and gathering mussels and blackberries. And it's a life that in many ways is unencumbered. And I think part of what readers respond to in her poetry is the sense that this is a person who experienced some kind of great sorrow. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't need to be specific about exactly what that was.
Here she is speaking to Krista Tippett about the natural world. Let's listen.
That the world is pretty much everything's mortal. It dies, but its parts don't die. Its parts become something else. And we know that when we bury a dog in the garden and with a rose bush on top of it. We know that there is replenishment. And that's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. A line from another poem. She wants to tell the wren, the sleepy dug-up clam, life goes on, life goes on. And yet you remind us that the critic David Orr wrote of her poetry, one can only say that no animals appear to have been harmed in the making of it. He also said of this idea of her poems overcoming personal challenges, if it worked as self-help, you'd see more poets driving BMWs. This, again, would be astonishing to her fans. What was the problem?
Well, I can't speak for David Orr, but I think it's astonishing that she was dismissed so, you know, out of hand the way she was by so many critics. You know, she didn't even receive a full-length review in the New York Times until Devotions came out.
And that was just recently.
That's right. And I think, you know, part of that is the relative simplicity of her language. Her poems sound like conversation. You don't need any kind of specialized education in order to read them and understand them. And that's kind of counter to the general trend in academic poetry criticism these days, where I think there tends to be a preference for poems that are encoded or, you know, seem to require some kind of specialized knowledge. And obviously that's something that's alienating to the general reader. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that Mary Oliver was deliberately trying to take advantage of that, but she certainly tapped into a vein of desire for a more plain-spoken, you know, more straight-to-the-heart form of poetry.
Let's listen to one. This is her 2001 reading of The Fish.
The first fish I ever caught would not lie down quiet in the pail, but flailed and sucked at the burning amazement of the air and died in the slow pouring off of rainbows. Later, I opened his body and separated the flesh from the bones and ate him. Now the sea is in me. I am the fish. The fish glitters in me. We are risen, tangled together, certain to fall back to the sea. Out of pain and pain and more pain, we feed this feverish plot. We are nourished by the mystery.
Yeah, I love that poem so much. And I think part of what we see in it is it begins with this, you know, very natural image from the real world, you know, that sounds like an experience. She's talking about the first time she went fishing and seeing what happens, the brutality of it. Mm. And then it takes this turn towards the end and becomes a religious poem in which the fish, you know, isn't just the fish anymore. It's the fish of Christ. And it rises into a meditation on the mystery of death and how all things come around again.
Well, and God is in everything. Thomas Mann wrote the book God of Dirt, Mary Oliver and the Other Book of God, making the point that her poetry does have theological interpretation because her poems address questions that are religious, like what is sacred, what is holy, what is our place in the family of things. And she wrote, I don't know who God is exactly, but I'll tell you this. If God exists, he isn't just butter and good luck. He's also the tick that killed my wonderful dog, Luke. If God exists, he isn't just churches and mathematics. He's the forest. He's the desert. He's the ice caps that are dying. Her sense that God was in everything and everyone.
That's right. The beautiful things and also the ugly things. And I think that's something that also has not been as appreciated as it might be about her work, is that these aren't just, you know, beautiful nature poems about birds and flowers. They're about brutality. They're about death. The corpse of the stillborn kitten that she finds and buries and what happens after that.
Well, and you mentioned death. She wrote about it. Her longtime partner, Molly Malone Cook, died in 2005. Mary Oliver had a bout with lung cancer. In her exquisite When Death Comes, like the hungry bear in autumn, she writes, "When it's over, I want to say all my life I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom taking the world into my arms. And when it's over, I don't want to wonder if I have made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world." She was very conscious of her mortality.
That's right. She talks about it in a number of poems, and always, again, with the emphasis, I think, that we hear in that poem, of mindfulness, of wanting to make the most of every moment to the extent possible. And, you know, maybe that's something also that seems too sincere for the irony of the Poetry Academy. It's almost embarrassing how enthusiastic she is for life and for the world. It's a position that we don't hear very much of these days. And I think, you know, it's something that there's a longing for.
And where would you put her in the pantheon of American poets?
Oh, I think, you know, among contemporary poets, certainly she's at the very top. She's had a wonderful, unique way of expressing, a way of looking at the world.
Ruth Franklin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll link you to Ruth's writing in The New Yorker, and we leave you with Mary Oliver reading portions of her Tropic of Cancer on Being.
The question is, what will it be like after the last day? Will I float into the sky, or will I fray within the earth or a river, remembering nothing? How desperate I would be if I couldn't remember the sun rising, if I couldn't remember trees, rivers, if I couldn't even remember, beloved, your beloved name. I know you never intended to be in this world, but you're in it all the same. So why not get started immediately? I mean, belonging to it. There is so much to admire, to weep over, and to write music or poems about.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Prince Philip, the 97-year-old husband of Queen Elizabeth, is said to be recovering from that nasty car accident that sent two people in the other car to the hospital. The prince flipped his car last Thursday on a country road near the Queen's estate in Norfolk, England. Police say the prince was at fault, but also that it happened in an area where he and others were blinded by sunlight, so it might not have had anything to do with age. It's raised questions, though, so let's bring in Cynthia Burt, Certified Driving Instruction and Driver Rehabilitation Specialist. Cynthia, in the U.S., we know that 30 states and the District of Columbia have some kind of older age requirement for driver's licenses. There's an eye test or shorter license renewal times. They kick in, though, from age 59 in Georgia to 85 in Texas. It's all over the map. So do you agree with others who say it's not necessarily age, but a driver's health that impairs driving?
That's correct. The problem is with health and activity levels of seniors. However, I do believe that there is enough evidence that shows that crash rates and fatalities increase after the age of 80, and I would recommend that there be some mandatory reporting to the state regarding health and driving after the age of 80.
You are a driver rehabilitation specialist. What does that mean?
So I have a medical background, and I take information regarding a person's physical, cognitive, and vision statuses and assess them in that way in the clinic, and then I see them in the car and do a road test with them.
Look, in 2015, 14 million Americans age 18 to 64 were estimated to be involved in accidents caused by drivers 65 and over. That's according to Consumer Reports. But are there more accidents in general caused by older drivers than not?
So accident rates are the highest at the age of 16, and they tend to decline until we're around the age of 30 to 35, where they stabilize. And then we do start to see an increase around the age of 70 to 79, but they seem, you know, to be still similar in younger ages. But specifically for fatal crashes, the ratio goes up similar to 20 to 25-year-olds in the 70 to 79 age range, and then they reach the same levels as a 16 to 17-year-old after the age of 80 if we look at million miles driven. But our seniors tend to drive less, so that's why we see less accident rates or fatality rates in those age ranges.
Well, given that 80-year-olds tend to have the same records as 16-year-olds, which at least some I know, that's a bad record. How do you approach a loved one, an older loved one, about maybe getting a little rehabilitation?
Well, my feeling is that we should always plan for driving retirement as we plan for financial retirement. That should be discussed with our families and our loved ones to talk about how we're going to transition from being a driver to a non-driver. So when events start to occur that are showing that maybe we need to stop driving, that it makes it easier on both the family and the driver.
That's Cynthia Burt, a certified driving instructor and driver rehabilitation specialist in Michigan. Cynthia, thank you.
Thank you.
And by the way, Prince Philip is set to be just fine.
The top Catholic bishops from around the world will gather at the Vatican for a historic summit 1 month from today. The topic will be sex abuse by the clergy. The aim will be to determine how to best protect children from sexual abuse. This meeting comes after a stream of painful revelations in the past year about violations in Catholic dioceses across the country.
Theodore McCarrick is no longer a cardinal. Pope Francis stripped him of his title over allegations of sexual abuse.
That was in July. McCarrick might be kicked out of the priesthood. A few weeks later, Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro announced that a grand jury named 300 priests implicated in the sexual abuse of at least 1,000 children.
Predators in every diocese weaponized the Catholic faith and used it as a tool of their abuse.
Later, an Illinois attorney general announced that hundreds more priests there stand accused of abuse than the church had publicly identified. And in the Archdiocese of Boston, two seminarians made allegations of a toxic culture at a seminary. They told of sexual misconduct and intimidation among faculty and seminarians. Boston Cardinal Sean O'Malley launched an inquiry. He was criticized for appointing church insiders to conduct it. O'Malley later hired a former U.S. attorney to lead the investigation. These allegations no longer surprise many Catholics in the once thriving Catholic community in Boston. The priest scandal first broke in the city 17 years ago. That's when the Boston Globe published an exposé on the archdiocese. It revealed that hundreds of priests had sexually abused children for decades, and church leaders had covered it up. Some Catholics in Boston say the litany of recent revelations compounds their pain.
I wish it had all come out at once. These bits and pieces are doing a job on the church, that's for sure.
Maureen Gannon is a member of St. Bridget Parish in the suburb of Framingham. She fears that all this bad news is burying the good that the Catholic Church does. She prays the scandals will end, and she gets angry.
I have 14 grandchildren, and I want them to continue as Catholics, and they're not going to do it if this keeps happening.
Other St. Bridget parishioners say they separate their faith from the lapses in their church. Parishioner Grace Mina.
Those who are wronged, I want them to have the justice that they seek. And I want those who wronged them to be meted out the justice that they deserve. But it does not really affect me with my relationship with the Lord.
It seems like, you know, deja vu all over again, and even worse, with even more pain, I think.
Barbara Thorpe worked for the Boston Archdiocese. She directed the office that provides pastoral and mental health support to survivors of priest abuse. She did so for a decade.
We had enough. We knew enough to move forward, and we didn't.
And the "we" refers to who?
The global church.
Thorpe criticizes the global church for not implementing the reforms the Boston Archdiocese has. Father John Connolly is at St. Teresa of Avila in Boston. He says the way forward for the church is obvious.
This thing is easy to understand how to fix if you take as your prime directive the protection of children.
Connolly previously worked with Boston's Cardinal O'Malley. He coordinated the archdiocese response to priest sex abuse. He and Barbara Thorpe credit the cardinal for helping to right the ship. The archdiocese has instituted yearly criminal background checks on all clergy, staff, and volunteers. It's also implemented abuse prevention training for employees and even Catholic school students. The archdiocese mandates that all allegations of abuse get reported to law enforcement and publishes the names of accused clergy, even though it took almost a decade to make those names public. Father Connolly says these changes in Boston are vital.
The culture of silence and secrecy that prevailed for decades is no longer the norm, and that needs to be replicated in the church throughout the world.
Many Catholics felt the church had a chance to chart a new course this past fall when the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops met in Baltimore. They were planning to vote on protocols for how bishops would be investigated for abuse and held accountable for proper handling of abuse allegations. But Pope Francis ordered the group to do nothing until bishops from around the world convene at the Vatican next month. Many Catholics considered the Pope's action another blow to a church that's a shadow of what it was decades ago. More than 100 parishes in the Boston Archdiocese have closed in the past 30 years, and the number of people in the pews has steadily declined, as it has nationally. The Archdiocese says only about 12% of Catholics in the region attend Mass. Daphne Collins lives just outside of Boston.
I started as a deeply religious Catholic coming from a family of deep culture. My mother carved saints.
She has family roots in Catholicism going back centuries all the way to Spain.
I know my prayers in Spanish and English.
Collins has long wanted the church to allow women and married people to become priests. But the disclosures of abuse last summer brought her to the breaking point. She stopped going to Mass.
I really believe that our purpose in life is to know God and to serve others. And yet, here I belong into this organization that is no reflection to all the humanity that belongs to this organization. They say, well, it's going to take a long time for these things to change. It's such an old institution. Well, you know, I'm an old institution. I'm 61. In my lifetime, this is an old time. And it's time for me to just be authentic to myself.
Collins now worships with Quakers in a nearby town. Carrie Rodriguez of the suburb Medford, on the other hand, still attends Mass several times a week at St. Anthony Shrine in downtown Boston.
What happens in this building is faith in action every single day.
The Shrine's mission is rooted in social justice. Rodriguez and her children are part of a church group that hands out food, socks, and scarves to people who are homeless.
Dysfunction that happens in the Catholic Church, the overarching organization, that's a million miles from what is happening in this building. The church and the Roman Catholic organization that was created by men, this work that you're seeing on our street, in this shrine, is the work that we have been called to as Catholics.
That sense of connection with those who are suffering keeps student Angelo Jesus Canta in the church. He studies theology at Boston College. He only knows a Catholic church in crisis.
When the Pennsylvania grand jury report came out, when the revelations about Cardinal McCarrick and sort of the depth of the corruption and the abuse came out, I was very angry. But the struggle and the anger has not given me enough reason to jump ship.
Canta may be bucking a trend. Studies find about a third of adults who are raised Catholic don't stay Catholic. Helen Drinan has stayed with her religion, but she doesn't trust the church.
I think that trust, once lost, is an extremely difficult thing to regain.
Drinan is president of Simmons University. She used to work for the Boston Archdiocese hospital system. She left in a dispute with a cardinal over allegations the hospital CEO was sexually harassing women staffers. Last year, Drinan wrote an op-ed in the Globe titled, "This Catholic Has Lost Patience with the Church." She questioned why it takes attorneys general across the U.S. to uncover criminal activity by priests and why the church itself isn't doing it. And Drinan's anger at the church as an institution extends further.
So much of the church is male-dominated. Women are, I'll use the phrase second-class citizens. I'm not even sure if second-class addresses the real status of women in the church, let's step back and say, what has made institutions run really, really well? And we know, for example, that diversity in decision-making makes for better decisions. In public companies that have women in the lead, their performance in the marketplace goes up.
Many of the Catholics we spoke with expressed hope that as wrongdoings of the church continue to unspool, they'll lead to a kind of epiphany, a rebirth of the church. Boston College theology professor Tom Groom hopes disheartened and dismayed Catholics hold on to their faith.
I think they have to recognize that, yes, their Catholic Church and the structures of it made dreadful mistakes, but that this faith is a deeply life-giving faith. It's the largest educator in the world, a huge social service system. And to simply let go of it, all of that, because our institution has failed us, I think that would be sad.
Professor Groom's wish for the Catholic Church is echoed by Barbara Thorpe, the woman who worked with abuse survivors in the Boston Archdiocese. She finds reason to be hopeful.
As bad as this new moment is, I think we are more in a time of light than in darkness, because it is the light that's exposing these things that have been hidden and in secret and need to be addressed.
The eyes of the faithful will be on the Vatican next month when Pope Francis meets with leading bishops worldwide on the issue of how to protect minors from sexual abuse.
British Prime Minister Theresa May was back at it today, rejecting calls to delay the UK's departure from the European Union, telling the House of Commons today that she will press ahead to try to win support for her Brexit plan in Parliament.
In the next few days, my ministerial colleagues and I will continue to meet with members on all sides of the House and with representatives of the trade unions, business groups, civil society and others as we try to find the broadest possible consensus on a way forward.
She faces a serious uphill battle in getting that consensus because you'll remember Parliament handed her that historic defeat last week, fully rejecting her Brexit deal by 230 votes. But then she won a vote of confidence, kept her job by a far better margin than that Brexit vote would indicate. Rob Watson is BBC political correspondent. He joins us now from London. Rob, for those here on this side of the pond saying, wait, I thought it was what? They're leaving, they're not. Just give us the thumbnail. What did she want that was so roundly rejected?
Well, we all feel like that. As I often say, Robin, that if when it comes to Brexit, if you're not confused, it means you're not paying attention properly. So I'll let that one sink in. I guess what's been really striking about what's happened in Parliament today is that after the most thumping defeat in the history of parliamentary democracy in Britain since this sort of system in its current form was set up in the 18th century, she's essentially come back to Parliament, not as many people either in this country or maybe around the world would have expected, some radical different plan. She's essentially come back and said, well, I listened to what everyone had to say, but guess what? I think my plan is best. I mean, she didn't put it in quite those words. But essentially, she is saying, despite that absolute drubbing, that she still thinks that her deal, the one that she struck with the EU 27 leaders in November, that something like that is going to have to be what Britain does.
Well, and then again, give us a thumbnail. What was the sticking point? What is it that people didn't like?
Well, it's really interesting because there's more than one, as you wouldn't be surprised. Mm. But I guess to sort of sum it up, those who are really enthusiastic about Brexit on the right wing of her governing Conservative Party think that her deal leaves Britain far too close to the European Union. And wait for it, drum roll, those in her party and in the opposition parties who are more pro-EU think that the arrangements don't leave Britain close enough or are far too vague. So in a way, her deal didn't satisfy anyone then, and it probably doesn't now either.
Yeah. Well, she said today she plans to continue meeting with her opponents and her supporters. But so far, the leader of the opposition, Labour Party Minister Jeremy Corbyn, has not met with the Prime Minister. Will he? Is this sort of a Nancy Pelosi, Donald Trump thing? I mean, does he have to?
It's not like that at all. No, he doesn't. And I think he won't. I mean, as in the United States, politics in the UK are immensely tribal. And I don't think Theresa May was ever particularly serious about reaching out to him because that would involve splitting her governing Conservative Party. And I don't think the opposition parties, including Jeremy Corbyn, are particularly serious about reaching out to her. Because
I have to say, Rob, that sounds exactly like the United States.
Well, it is, except that the Brexit issue is rather different. And, you know, again, to go back to basics on Brexit, that what it does is that it splits both the main parties in Britain. I mean, that's what makes it so chaotic. I mean, it's why Britain is in this profound crisis, the most profound since the Second World War, that neither the main opposition party, the Labour Party, nor the governing Conservative Party can decide what to do about the result of that referendum. How long ago? 2 years and 9 months?
Right. Imagine that. Look, what is the thinking about why she's sticking to her guns? Does she really feel that any other deal is impossible? I mean, in that way, this is her wall. Or is it political, or is the sense that she really does believe that this is the best plan?
Robin, let me try and deal with Theresa May's wall of Brexit and the question you asked. There are a number of reasons. I mean, the first is a personality one. She's immensely stubborn. I mean, Theresa May has qualities. Stubbornness is probably one of them. The second is about politics. So one of the things that's been driving her all along is that she doesn't want to split the governing Conservative Party, which is hopelessly split over Europe, and maybe that's just a vain project. And then the third thing is she is obsessed about delivering the result of the referendum. I mean, she thinks, even though she was a Remainer, you have to deliver on the referendum, otherwise there could be sort of social upheaval from the from the people who voted Leave. And she thinks that her deal is the only way to deliver on that without trashing the UK economy and while keeping her Conservative Party together. But it may just be wrong. And I think a lot of Theresa May's critics will say is that she just hasn't maybe levelled with herself and the British people that there is no good or easy way of doing Brexit. There is no way of doing it which doesn't damage the UK's economy and its standing in the world.
Mm. What happens next?
Goodness gracious. I think what happens next is that Theresa May hopes that the sort of clock ticking down will somehow frighten MPs from her own governing Conservative Party into supporting her deal. Meanwhile, there's a separate track, and that is that moderate politicians from both the main parties, they will do their best to try and pass a law, or at least force the government to extend the departure date so as Britain can see if it can sort out this mess.
BBC political correspondent Rob Watson in London. Rob, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. Good to be with you. Hope everyone's still confused.
We wouldn't be paying attention.
Quite.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.